It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the director of a prominent political poll in the U.S. says he screwed up and maybe we shouldn't do horse race polls anymore during election seasons. Our guest makes the case that the polling crisis is maybe a catastrophe for American democracy. First, an insult directed toward President Biden has become a rallying cry for many conservatives. The phrase, "Let's go, Brandon," went viral when a reporter apparently misheard a vulgar chant about the president from a crowd at a NASCAR race. Now it's all over social media, political rallies, even a rap song that briefly went to number one on the iTunes charts. We're learning more about why these types of slogans and memes take off and what impact, if any, they have on the political landscape. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this one? Do you follow political memes? Do you share them from one side or another? Are you bothered by the language inferred in this particular message? Or is this a fad that will fade and you're not worried about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be here.
What makes a political meme or slogan, maybe like this one, go viral these days?
If we could predict that, we could make quite a bit of money in the world of politics. It's really hard to know. There's not the work that kind of looks at virality finds that there aren't really necessarily key features that are always good predictors of whether something goes viral. The things that seem to be the best predictors or the most often accurate include things that come with some deal of emotion, often anger. But that's a little bit different than the "Let's Go Brandon" chant, which is a little more tongue in cheek, covering up for a more vulgar chant, you know, and that sort of thing. Although it's rooted, I suppose, in anger that those who don't support President Biden might feel about him.
When a catchphrase emerges like this one, and I think you could probably point toward others, some targeting former President Trump, it doesn't seem like anybody's going to hear this and change their mind about a president. It seems like, though, it is a marker, a way for people to share, to express a shared identity. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that chants like this can do when it comes to how we might better understand our political moments. So one is that it can serve as sort of a way to signal what side you're on and offer those who share your side a safe haven to share views. And so people who are sharing that meme or engaging in that chant, or maybe they wryly say to a neighbor while standing, you know, at the crosswalk, something like that, can signal what side they're on. And so there's a little bit of an opportunity to kind of engage in some solidarity building or group signaling and that sort of thing. But it also can serve to shape how other political observers interpret the contemporary moment, right? We're talking about this on the radio right now, right? So this kind of chant or these kinds of political memes and slogans can also serve to direct conversation away from other things, right? President Biden just signed into law a gigantic legislative bill that, you know, is likely to be even more popular than it is now once some of the elements of the bill start to happen. And so if you're an opponent of the president, you want to divert attention from that. And a slogan like this might be a way to do it.
And I know you put a lot of work into following how people congregate in the social media world, on the media spectrum, and how ideas flow. If we think of a slogan like this as, you know, a dye you put into our you know, those things for where they do X-rays and they put a dye in you, like, how would you try to track how this sort of thing goes and spreads in social media?
So we would want to start with who are the central nodes, who are doing the most spreading and then getting the most engagement. In other words, who's sharing this kind of meme or this hashtag, say, on Twitter, and then who's liking that tweet, who's retweeting it, who's commenting in positive ways on it, and then what are the shape of their networks that these folks are connecting to, and how do these things spread? Are they in a homogeneous network where it's just kind of bouncing around the political right and not really getting much purchase among those who are in the middle or on the left? Or is it something that's crossing ideological lines and being seen by lots of other folks? One thing we would also then look for is how the other side, would try to reappropriate the message, right? So, for example, during the Obama years, there was a hashtag Thanks Obama that conservatives would use to complain about things they didn't like about President Obama's presidency. Over time, liberals began using Thanks Obama when good things would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so the you know, unemployment is down, hashtag Thanks Obama, and it becomes kind of an ironic comment on how the meme was originally used. And so one thing we would also want to look for is, is there a backlash to the meme or the chant or the slogan? And is it being reasserted on the other side as a badge of honor or a point of pride?
And I've seen that is happening. At least one political group is going with a thank you, Brandon, message, much like the thanks, right, Obama, and referring in part to the infrastructure bill you just mentioned. So these things become contested. They're footballs. I don't know. Is it just fun and goofy, or is there something real here?
I think those aren't mutually exclusive categories. I think it is a little goofy, you know, but I think there also is something going on, right? It has captured the imagination of some people who cover politics and comment on politics. Some people who work in politics interpret this as a tea leaf reading of what the mood of the country is. I think that's probably overwrought and a little bit overdone, just as we often try to interpret what one election in one state means for what, say, the next congressional set of elections are going to mean, or what the next presidential election is going to look like. I think we can overinterpret some of these things and think that they are a stronger signal than perhaps they really are.
We're talking about political memes, slogans, and catchphrases, how they spread, what they do and don't mean. Mike Wagner is with us from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, I was reminded of an old political slogan, 140 years ago or so, about Grover Cleveland in a presidential campaign. Ma, ma, where's my pa? Referring to an adultery scandal. And then it got reconfigured and people added, gone to the White House, ha, 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 when he won. How new is this?
Yeah, in some respects, there is nothing new under the sun. We have had slogans since we had people seeking public attention, right? And so from Tippecanoe and Tyler II and William Henry Harrison's election to Abraham Lincoln's, you know, not wanting to change horses in midstream, when he was running for re-election, to Ulysses S. Grant's slogan related to vote the way you shot. You know, these are all things that have been a part of our country's politics. Happy days are here again with Franklin Roosevelt, or I'm just wild about Harry. Some of these things became songs, right? And so, or were crafted from songs in other cases. And so there's always been a relationship between slogans, music, art, public commentary, and we've seen that stuff really kind of get, you know, supersized in our era. For example, Barack Obama's "Yes We Can" became a slogan, but it also then became an artistic piece and a music video that Will.i.am created, and it gave the Obama campaign all of this extra free attention that was building off of the slogan from a speech he gave after winning the Iowa caucus, you know, in the beginning of the 2008 presidential campaign. So we see these sorts of things all the time, and we see them, you know, that are positive, like "Yes, We Can." We see them negative, like "Lock Her Up," which Donald Trump used in his campaign for the White House the first time. And then we see, you know, sillier ones like "Let's Go, Brandon," which, you know, is a dig at President Biden without mentioning him by name.
How about messages crafted to frame a policy item? And here I'm thinking of something like death panels, claims of death panels in the Affordable Care Act. They weren't there, but it was a phrase that was tested and spread and may, I think people might still argue this, may have helped turn public opinion against the Affordable Care Act.
There are lots of examples throughout our history of policy debate where the way that issues get framed can influence public support for them. And so the death panels is a good example, or whether we frame attacks on money people might inherit from their parents as a estate tax or a death tax, for example, right? Do we think about abortion rights as an issue of life for a fetus or choice for a person who is pregnant. And so we see these sorts of frames dominate some policy discussions. More often than not, news coverage of policy debates focus on who's winning and losing, which makes the framing of the issue and the kinds of ways both sides try to characterize what the issue means important for how the public understands what the stakes are and eventually we would hope what the actual content of the legislation is, although research suggests that we learn a lot more about the content of legislation after the votes are cast and not before.
We're talking about political memes inspired in part by the latest viral phrase among conservatives. Let's go, Brandon. Digging deeper than that, though, our guest today is UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a problem with people using the phrase, let's go, Brandon? Do you pass along yourself harmless fun? What about other political memes? Are they distractions from more important stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner, talking about viral political slogans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the state of our political discourse, our conversation about politics? What ideas or solutions do you have for improving it? Do you think social media has made things better, worse, or just different when it comes to the way we communicate about politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I studied journalism when I was in college. I didn't get that as a degree, but we called it American Studies. And so I've always had an ear to the rail about, you know, politics in our country. And I want to ask the professor why it seems to me that the mainstream media is ignoring the right wing, which says that the, you know, the Democrats hold both houses of Congress and the White House. So they're saying that their agenda is communism and socialism. In other words, forced mandates. They're going to take away the Second Amendment rights, the First Amendment right to free speech. They're closing churches, you know, instead of, you know, bars and restaurants during a pandemic. Why doesn't the mainstream media address the accusation that communists and socialists are in power in Washington?
Jeff, thanks for the call. I mean, we see those claims, I think, from conservatives. Do you think, Mike, the media doesn't give it a fair hearing?
I would actually say that the news media is more willing to just broadcast some of those accusations without thoughtful engagement with whether they're true or not. We see lots of coverage in the news where we'll see a soundbite from a political leader claiming that the president is a communist, or that Big Bird is a communist, or that Nancy Pelosi is a socialist. And those things are not true. And so one thing news organizations can do is combat false statements with the verifiable truth. But it's also a danger for journalists to uncritically service stenographers in some cases, in national politics especially, where claims made by opponents of people in power are repeated without thoughtful questioning of whether or not the claims are true. And so no one has lost their speech rights in the Biden administration. The Biden administration has not signed a bill or done anything close to that that would restrict people's rights to own a gun. And so claims that those things have happened should not be amplified because they haven't happened.
It's going out of Sherry in Elkhorn at 800-642-1234. Sherry, hi.
Hi. I just think we ought to turn it around and, like, do a positive spin on it. I don't care what you call me, Brandon or Biden, but let's go.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. And there's the thank you, Brandon, that I mentioned earlier. Mike, as other sides try to take each other's slogans and twist them to their own benefit.
That insight from the caller is something that a lot of politicians try to do. And often when they do it, it takes some of the power away from the slogan or meme or thing that's getting attention. President Obama famously did that by, saying people want to call the Affordable Care Act Obamacare, and like that's some kind of attack. And the president then president would say, I think that sounds nice. Obama cares. I'm all for calling it Obamacare. You know, so those sorts of things some strategic politicians will try to take that ammunition and turn it back around and turn it into something positive, just as the caller was talking about it. So there are lots of examples of that throughout American history and in American politics. Some more successful than others, but it's often a strategy that can diffuse the effort to attack.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about political messaging and political memes, how they spread, how they go viral, with Mike Wagner from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, do you see one party or the other or one politician or another being particularly good or effective at capturing a simple meme, a simple idea or phrase, and making it stick?
I think that former President Trump had a great skill at that. He was very good. Long before he ran for president, he was a very avid user of Twitter and a regular guest on various kinds of television talk shows. And so he regularly had chances to kind of workshop ideas and test what sorts of things get more engagement and get more positive associations with them. And then there are literally examples of him on the campaign trail in 2016 and then throughout his presidency and his run, unsuccessful bid for re-election, where he would be in crowds and literally just tell the audience he's testing different lines to see which ones they like better. And he had a pretty strong and acute sense, I think, for what sorts of phrases his core audience would respond to. And he was very good at deploying those. He also, I think, had a strong sense for what kinds of phrases would generate extra media attention, which was also something that I think he was is uniquely good at.
How can we in the media be careful about giving that, I think marketing people call it, earned media that the source didn't pay for in advertising, and just caving in to effective messages like that?
That's a great question. I think that reporters and editors and news directors should be asking themselves, what's the news value of the slogan? Is it a one-day story where a reporter mishears something and it's kind of a funny story, like the origin of Let's Go Brandon, and so we cover it once or twice? Or maybe we cover the original genesis of the story and then note, oh, now some people are using it as a slogan, and then that might be one story. But to cover it over and over and over is kind of buying into something that really doesn't tell us what kind of job is President Biden doing. What are the ideas of his opponents? These are things we don't learn from extended coverage of a slogan. And so there's only so much airtime. There's only so many column inches. There's only so long people will spend online reading or watching information. And so if we're choosing to fill it with this and not other things, then we can't learn about the other things.
How much does the media not matter in how these kind of things spread with social media, and you're on this group on Facebook or you follow this person, you're way less likely to do this person on Twitter? How much is the media out of loop in the spread of these kind of ideas?
I would say that a lot of things that get their start on social media might not need traditional media to circulate widely for a short period of time, but to sustain it, traditional media is required. If any kind of meme or slogan or phrase or movement is to be sustained, there needs to be a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the churn of sharing that information on social media and the attention it gets from mainstream and also from more ideologically or advocacy-oriented news outlets. It's really an interaction between those things that keep these kinds of stories alive.
And staying on social media, Mike, there's a lot of focus, especially on Facebook and the platforms it owns, on how information and especially misinformation can spread on these platforms. What are you watching for as these companies make internal efforts, as Congress thinks about external efforts to try to change the way information flows?
I think some things to watch for are, do social media companies use their terms of service consistently? Do they apply them equally to different kinds of actors and different kinds of misinformation? Or is it idiosyncratic, haphazard? Do some people keep getting chance after chance while other people get removed from the platform? I think that's one thing to look for. Another thing to look for is what sorts of things on Twitter are trending, what sorts of things on Facebook are in that kind of top five engagements that you can see that are coming up on Facebook in any given day. And it gives you a sense of what the algorithm is privileging and what sorts of messages, what sorts of conversations are being shared the most widely. And we've seen on Facebook, for example, often kind of the top five engaged with posts come from folks on the right or the far right. And in recent weeks, that seems to have changed. It's possible that Facebook is changing what they privilege in their algorithm. And so watching for those things are I think, smart ways for those of us who use social media to understand what we're coming in contact with because we're out there looking for what our friends are up to versus what we're coming in contact with and being exposed to because the algorithm is privileging some misinformation or information over other information.
Can you leave us, Mike, in our last half a minute or so with advice for that social media user on their phone or computer or whatever to make sure they're getting good quality stuff?
If it sounds really good for your side and really bad for the other side, find a second source. People really love to believe things that make them feel good and the other side feel bad. It's a natural human inclination. Find someone else who says it too before you're too quick to endorse it. Think before you share, and see if you can't maybe expose yourself to a source that you normally wouldn't, just to see what else is out there.
Mike, thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner. He joined us for a look at what makes political memes and slogans go viral. Mike's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Coming up, after another major poll was off significantly, we'll explore whether it's time to do away with election polls. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to attorney Jarrett Adams, who served 10 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit and now works as a lawyer trying to overturn wrongful convictions. He'll share his story and how to change what he sees as a broken criminal justice system. Now, the director of the Monmouth University poll did something unusual recently. He wrote an op-ed in the Star-Ledger in New Jersey and apologized to Democratic Governor Phil Murphy, his Republican challenger Jack Tortorelli, and the voters of that state. The final poll before the election 2 weeks ago was way off. It had Murphy up by 11 points. That night, it looked like he might actually lose. He wound up winning by 2. In response, pollster Patrick Murray wrote, "I blew it," and that, quote, "inaccurate public polling can have an impact on fundraising and voter mobilization efforts." He also raised a question that, since so many polls have been wrong in recent years, is horse race polling for elections still worth doing? Our next guest says if public opinion data is no longer reliable, American democracy could be in trouble. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about election polls? Do you pay attention to them or do you ignore them? How much confidence do you have in political polling today? Have you been polled? What was it like? Did you give honest responses? Did you hang up the phone? What do you think would be a better way of measuring how people feel about a particular race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He wrote a piece after last November's elections saying that the polling crisis is a potential catastrophe for U.S. democracy. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You saw this piece by pollster Patrick Murray, a pretty influential poll, Monmouth University. What was your reaction to what he had to say?
Well, it was really interesting. And I think it is something to take seriously because Murray is a really well-respected pollster and his polls tend to be very good. And you know, his takeaway that maybe these sort of horse race polling, especially at the end of election, is a bad thing is really interesting. And that's the kind of thing you don't see pollsters saying a lot. But I think he's onto something. I mean, it's clearly true that we have an unhealthy relationship with polls in this country, and especially between the press and polls in this country. And I think, you know, the backlash after these elections is another example of that.
What do you see as the point of having horse race polls, even if they were good? If we had good, reliable horse race polls that did a pretty good job of predicting the outcome of an election, would that be worth doing?
Well, I think everybody just wants to know. I mean, whether it's almost a question of like whether it's worth doing is a little bit beyond the point, because people clearly want to know. We see this in the popularity of polls. We see it in the popularity of places like 538 and, you know, the New York Times Upshot. Like, people just want to know who's up and who's down. And that is both readers and that's the press. So you can see why there's a demand for it. And, you know, I like to know that too. It's useful to know who might be winning. I think that's important for the press and understanding sort of who to cover and how to cover them. But I also think that can get out of whack to the point where, instead of covering the candidates with the polls as a sort of important input and something to illuminate the way we do that, it becomes what we cover. It is the sole focus.
Right. And that could lead to how does this policy affect the candidate in the polling? Is that where you see the coverage getting unhealthy?
Yeah, or like even not to that point. I mean, that's a sort of a level of complication beyond some of what we get, which is what do the polls say? And I've said this before, but I find it really striking. When Nate Silver created 538 during the 2008 election cycle, he thought that it would allow reporters to stop covering polls poorly, which he rightly said a lot of people were doing, and instead to cover policy issues more. And instead now what you see is a lot of us just write about whatever 538 happens to be saying from day to day and week to week.
Apart from how we use the polls, there's also concern about polls being off, and it's happened in a handful of elections, very high-profile elections lately. Do you have thoughts on why they're missing the mark?
It's a really good question, and it's a question that the polling industry is grappling with. You know, we had this big miss in 2016, and afterwards pollsters went back and looked at their numbers and concluded the error had been that they were not sufficiently weighting for education, which means basically they thought that there were going to be, that the electorate was going to be more educated than it did. There were more white non-college educated voters than they believed there would be. And so they were going to fix that in the 2020 election. And they did, many of them. They started paying attention to that. And yet they still missed by several points in a lot of these races. And so there have been similar postmortems after the 2020 election. And they don't really have an answer. I mean, one answer is people, not the right people are answering their phones. The people who are answering their phones seem to be more liberal and more educated, which makes it harder to get a representative sample. But overall, they don't know why, and they don't have a consensus answer about how to fix it either.
Talking to David Graham from The Atlantic about a crisis in political polling, especially those election polls. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experience if you have been polled. 800-642-1234. Well, I'll answer a phone now. Let's hear from Jake in Appleton. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Jake?
You know, I just wanted to share that I'm 28 and I've had the opportunity to vote in three different presidential elections. And every time I've been called for polling, it's always been before debates. And the last two out of the three elections, I've actually changed my decision based on the feedback from the results of those debates. So I think if you poll too early, it leaves a lot on the table for those who are still on the border, or there's issues that are more, you know, important to one for another reason or another. So that's just my feedback on it.
Sure. And Jake, I wanted to ask, when you get these polls, are they just kind of quick hits who you're voting for, or do they dig deep to try to find out more about you?
Very, very light on the demographic information, essentially just a red or blue voter, no information on gender or any other type of information that they could better track demographic related patterns. So it's surprising there too, if you're going to take the time to call me, at least get to know me, right?
Interesting, Jake. Well, I'm glad we got to know you a little bit here. David, what do you think about Jake's experience being polled?
Well, one, I mean, it's remarkable to be polled that many times. And I think that maybe is a little bit of a factor of living in an important swing state. Something you hear from a lot of people is, well, I've never been polled, so the polls can't be genuine. Although statistically, the odds of actually getting polled are remarkably low. I think his point about the debates is really interesting. One of the polls that, one of the kinds of polling we see, there are different kinds of polls, but sometimes you'll try to poll a representative sample and a pollster will choose a different representative sample every time around. Other ones will stick with the same group of people, and then you can sort of track how they're changing their views over the course of an election season. Those polls have had a pretty good performance the last couple cycles. So maybe there's something to what he's saying. I'd also say, like, one thing he's pointing to there is, and your question is, the difference in quality in pollsters. Some of these pollsters are simply a lot better than others. They're more careful, they're doing more work, they're getting larger samples. And so it's important to look at who the pollsters are. But even some of the high quality ones have had some notable misses recently.
Jake, thanks for that call. We're talking about election polls and whether they're useful or useless or some point in between. David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about polling today? When it is election season, do you watch polls? Compulsively, maybe, whether you want to or not, can't stop refreshing 538, or do you ignore them? Do you think they're harmful in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk about political polling in an op-ed piece in the New Jersey Star-Ledger. The director of the Monmouth University poll says he blew the governor's race in that state, and maybe it's time to get rid of election polls. Our guest says America's polling crisis is a big deal. We can't count on polls to accurately measure how people think. David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow polls? Do you think they're a waste of time? Have you been polled yourself? What was it like? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I always love your show.
Thanks.
Love the way you work it, and it oozes of intellectualism.
Is that good? I can't tell. But go ahead, Paul.
Knowledge is power. It's, you know, having a view of things as they develop is a really good thing. I think when we talk about that, we have different sources, some of them reliable, some of them not reliable. We start to fall into, I think, a trap with the tribalist politics that we've been playing, especially of late. And we start thinking more team than we do sort of the outcome and governance in general. So I find it to be a very negative thing to sort of overdo it like we do so many other things. And I guess that's all I have to say.
Paul, thanks. Interesting point. David, polling might just be reinforcing our tribal divisions, as Paul says it. And maybe when we answer a poll, we're just telling you what team we're on.
I think that's exactly right. There's a real feedback loop there. A lot of questions, if you look at them, they look like sort of how do you feel? Really, you know, whatever the answer that's being asked, the answer looks a lot like how do you feel about Donald Trump? You know, that's questions of, you know, whether you thought the election was fair and so on and so forth. You can look down the line. And it's not clear that we're really measuring people's true views about what they feel, but they know what the quote unquote right response for their team is. And then once those numbers get in polls, people see those polls and they are reinforcing what they think the quote unquote right answer for their team is. So I think there's a real feedback loop there that does kind of feed into tribalism.
Thanks for that call, Paul, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Sarah with us in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hello. You caught me eating just a second.
Early lunch or just a snack?
No, just a snack. Okay. That I shouldn't have been eating anyway. So anyway, I just wonder how, I don't know how much they gave you of the information. I'm just wondering how much pollsters are being affected by people like our family and friends who are so sick of all the fraudulent calls we get and scam calls that we really don't answer our phones anymore unless we recognize the number.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that. And David, Sarah and her friends and family are not alone. A lot of people won't pick up a phone, period, and certainly not from an unrecognized number like a pollster might have.
That's exactly right. And now, there's also a generational effect where, you know, a lot of younger voters simply don't have landlines, and it's harder to dial cell phones and to get a hold of cell phones. So this is a real problem for pollsters. They have tried various ways to get around this. One thing is they just try to reweight. So if they get too small a sample of a certain demographic compared to what they expect in the electorate, they will sort of, you know, sort of double that in the weight. The other thing they've done is they're experimenting with different ways of polling, like using the internet. And for a long time, internet polling was looked down on as inaccurate. The last few years, as methods have gotten better, some pollsters have had pretty good results using internet polling. But the gold standard remains getting people on the phone, and that's harder to do these days.
Sarah, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Graham from The Atlantic about a crisis in political polling. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Just a few minutes. Going to have an open call in. You can share your thoughts. How do you use polls? Do you ignore them completely? Do you think they're a problem? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, I want to ask about another kind of polling. We've been focusing on the horse race. Are you going to vote for candidate A or B or C or D if they're out there? How about issue polling? Some people have said this is better because you're not trying to predict turnout, who's actually going to vote in the election. It can give a snapshot of what people think about abortion, gun control, marijuana legalization, whatever.
Yeah, I think issue polling is an important tool, especially in the sort of fragmented nation we have now. People are the general unit is no longer the sort of town meeting. We are increasingly sorted into neighborhoods and cities based on people we agree with. And so we don't get a sort of a wide range of opinion. Our representatives in Congress have larger and larger constituencies compared to what they were historically. So it's just a lot harder to know what people think without those issue polls. And that's why I think polling, despite its flaws, can't really be thrown out. Now, you know, issue polling has its flaws. It seems like in a lot of cases you get answers that suggest, on polling, suggest a much more liberal population than what we actually have. But as Patrick Murray pointed out of Monmouth in that piece, they're a little less fraught because you're not trying to predict who is going to turn out to vote. What you're trying to do is simply measure how the population feels, and that's an easier task, you know, less prone to mistakes about guesses.
I'm thinking back to those 80s commercials on TV where there's got to be a better way to do whatever it was. Is there a better way, do you think, to have good, constructive conversations in American politics that really give us insight to what people are thinking?
I think it's really hard, especially in a big country. I mean, you can do a lot of these things on a smaller level. But I think the old way was flawed for a lot of reasons. You know, what you had was a few editors and at major TV stations and newspapers making guesses about what they believe people thought, and then making their coverage decisions from them and then feeding that to the population. And that is really, you can really get a warped idea. People who are sitting at a desk somewhere may not actually know what people are thinking out, many miles and many states away. And so having something that is actually data, I think, is really important. We just need to be more conscious, I think, about when we're giving too much weight to that data. And we also need to recognize that while it is data, it is not cold, hard science. There's human flaws in there and human assumptions. And we need to take that into account when we're interpreting them and making judgments based on them.
And in just our last half minute, before we throw things to our callers at 800-642-1234, David, you follow politics closely. Even with your doubts on polls, do you think you're going to be following them, say, in next year's election season?
Oh, you know it. I mean, I'm like the rat with the sugar water. I know it's bad for me, but I cannot resist it. It's just so alluring. And so I understand the impulse very well.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked to him about problems with election polling, why he says there's no longer a really reliable way of gauging how Americans feel about the horse race, if you want to think about it that way, leading up to an election. Now you can weigh in on that topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A straw poll on what you think of political polling. Have you lost faith in election polls? Did you ever have any to begin with? Like them or not, do you follow them more and more as election day approaches? Do you think there's a better way? Do you want to see less coverage of polls in the media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marcus joins us now in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon. Mr. Graham, the interesting discussion, but the article that you're citing, as I take it, wants to do away with polling that has to do with predicting at the accuracy of numbers. in advance, elections, so on. But what I've always found interesting watching polls over many, many years is that while polling is terrible at that, it's often very good at polling like or dislike. People aren't usually going to misrepresent that. So what I've noticed, regardless of administration, for instance, when you're talking about presidents, is that often at different periods, the president is very well liked as a person, their personality, but I find that in very high numbers, their policies are almost universally hated. So the policies are hated, but the people may be liked, which demonstrates to me that the public has almost zero influence on policy making.
Interesting. Marcus, thanks a lot for starting us off at 800-642-1234, taking your thoughts on election polling, polling in general. Mark joins us next in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hi there. So every so often I get one of these people calling me to take the poll, and I struggle because, frankly, I've never liked either candidate that's running, Republican or Democrat, and so I'm stuck. Because I can't honestly vote for either people. I'm voting for the one who I want to defeat the guy I like less.
So, Mark, you have trouble answering the poll. Come election day, if I may ask, do you find yourself choosing a candidate, or are you still stuck then?
I picked the candidate who is the least offensive.
Okay.
They both offend me, but the least offensive is the one I picked.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing. That'd be interesting if polls could. I mean, pollsters do try to measure that level of excitement or engagement with candidates. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Weird on Facebook from Luke, who says there are a lot of people out there who purposefully mess with polls given the opportunity to do so. That's their prerogative. But if you're going to do that, then stop complaining about polls being wrong. I know that's a concern among pollsters as well. Still time for you to share your thoughts on polling. If you follow them or not, or think they're bad in some way, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Zachary on Facebook, who says he feels like answering questions on a poll becomes clear they're steering you to the outcome they see as favorable. Interesting. I know there are push polls out there. Back to your calls now. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hello. Hi. I was listening interestedly to this, and I was started to think about how campaigns all do their internal polling, and then they make their decisions, a lot of them, based on their internal polling. And I'm wondering, and I haven't heard, like, if that's getting more unreliable, or is it? And are they doing less of it, or do they do it differently somehow that they think is more useful?
And Sarah, have you been polled ever yourself?
You know, I got one phone call once, and I just got irritated and I hung up.
Oh, no. Okay, so you didn't end up being counted in that one. I got you. Sarah, interesting. Thanks a lot for sharing that. I know I've talked to Charles Franklin from the Marquette poll about those internal polls for campaigns as well. But he says they're kind of guarded. We don't always know what is happening inside those polls and how well they do. Well, you can keep telling us how you feel about polls and surveys. You can do that in a couple different ways. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got an open conversation there. And we just heard from Ed, actually, on Facebook, who says, it's also time to end the process of suggesting the Democratic Party has also already lost the midterm election that will take place next year. There's a water that will go over the dam before the election takes place. Interesting point. The polling of today may not reflect the elections of a year from now. Again, keep sharing your thoughts on polling on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Thanks to everybody who weighed in on political polling. Thanks for standing up and being counted. And again, if you didn't get on, you got something to say, leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, electric vehicles are on the rise. More and more models coming out, more of them on the road. But are everyday drivers ready for them? And how about our infrastructure? Do we have the charging stations and other infrastructure needed to meet the needs of that new electric fleet? Check out the EV Future and share your thoughts, questions, and experiences. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Remember, you can follow all these conversations all the time. Head over to WPR.org, stream the Ideas Network and the NPR News and Classical Music Network live, and consult our archives while you're there, and take us with you wherever you go. Not just on a radio, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio to your tablet or smartphone. We'll be with you wherever you go. And, of course, share your thoughts on The Morning Show, Larry Miller Show, and here on Central Time. What's the right music for this time of day? New science shows we have different musical tastes depending on what time it is, but there's one song to rule them all. As reported by NPR, researchers in Denmark use data from the music streaming service Spotify to look at our music preferences throughout the day. Turns out there are five different music zones in a day where we listen to different kinds of stuff. For example, people want slow but energetic songs in the morning, louder, faster stuff in the afternoon, and danceable music in the evening. But one song remains popular in every time period. Yes, for some reason, Every Breath You Take by The Police from 1983 is popular in all five time groups. Why? A researcher says it's a very in-the-middle type of song. It's a medium tempo, a bit groovy, not too much groovy, doesn't have any loud surprises. It's all over just a very pleasant, perhaps even a bit bland song. Ringing endorsement. Every cake you bake, every leg you break, this is Central Time. Step you take, I'll be watching.